Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Katie Weaver. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Some Israelis are looking forward to going to Dubai and visiting the world's tallest building, the Burj Khalifa. Although people from all over the world visit Dubai, Israelis could not because the emirate did not have diplomatic relations with Israel. That will change soon. Last week, the United Arab Emirates announced plans to establish full diplomatic ties with Israel. That would make the UAE only the third Arab nation to do so. The move has caused a lot of interest in Israel. It will bring years of covert business and security ties into the open. And it will open an appealing destination for travel-happy Israelis. Israeli television stations have already sent reporters to the rich Persian Gulf nation. Local media has shown images of Dubai's tall, shiny buildings, huge shopping malls, man-made islands, and coastline. Newspapers have been publishing stories about a new Middle East. They are also stories about the Emirati economy, countryside, and ruling family. The United States negotiated the diplomatic deal between Israel and the UAE. The agreement also extends an alliance against Iran. The UAE has said it halted Israel's contentious plans to claim up to one-third of the West Bank. The Palestinians also want that land as part of a Palestinian state. For many Israelis, however, the appeal of ties with the UAE lies mainly in reaching their goal of acceptance in the Middle East. They also think that ties will improve tourism and business opportunities. Gadi Nir is co-founder and chief of Bobo, an Israeli company that makes physiotherapy and rehabilitative products. His business recently signed one of Israel's first deals with a UAE company. Nir told the Associated Press that in the past, his company had to use other companies to do business with the UAE. We used to have to launder the products and go through all kinds of intermediaries to do business with Arabs, said Nir. Now we can get personal. We don't have to hide under the carpet anymore, he added. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace estimates that hidden trade between Israel and the Gulf states is more than $1 billion a year. A large part of that is between Israel and the UAE. Now, those numbers are likely to increase. The agreement between the countries is supposed to include direct flights, although that could require approval from Saudi Arabia to use its airspace. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Monday that work to establish the flight paths was taking place. Israeli travel agents say they have already received many calls from Emirati travel agents. In addition, Israel's President Reuven Rivlin sent a letter to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan to invite him to visit Israel. The surprise statement last week has caused many people to wonder which Arab nation will be next. For Israel, Saudi Arabia, which still has not commented publicly on the UAE's decision, would be the biggest prize. It is not a surprise that the UAE would be the first state in the Gulf to establish ties with Israel. The UAE is a grouping of seven sheikhdoms that was founded in 1971. It has no major history with Jews, no shared border, and no direct conflict with Israel. Emirati officials have permitted Israeli government officials to visit in recent years. Some Israelis have long been interested in the UAE, and especially Dubai. Israelis who have foreign passports visit often. Israeli delegations have been given special permission to visit. Many Israelis hope ties with the UAE will develop into a far warmer relationship than those with Egypt and Jordan, which made peace with Israel after many years of conflict. Errol Margalit is an investor and a former Israeli lawmaker. He says there is Emirati interest not only in buying goods, but in joint investing in technology. Margalit predicted diplomatic ties would bring Israel closer to other Arab nations. It's about building relationships for the long term. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
A small but growing number of Americans are choosing to homeschool their children. Most U.S. schools plan to stay closed or open only part-time this year and offer distance learning programs to students. Some parents worry their neighborhood school will not offer a strong online learning program. Others are concerned about the health of their families if schools do reopen, partly or fully. Still others are choosing homeschooling because local schools keep changing their plans for the new term. Mindy Crosha of Lincoln, Nebraska, is a writer. She had been thinking she would homeschool her 12-year-old son this year. He has autism and ADHD, two conditions that already make middle school difficult for him. But Mindy Croshaw always felt her 10-year-old daughter was, in her words, built for school. Now, with the COVID-19 health crisis continuing, she is pulling both children out for the coming school year. We just saw that with her wearing a mask for the entire day, that would make learning more difficult for her, Croshaw said. It was going to be such a different environment. Homeschooling applications are on the rise in several states, including Nebraska, which has had a 21% increase. In Vermont, applications are up 75%. There were about 2.5 million homeschool students last year in levels 1 through 12 plus kindergarten. That represents 3 to 4% of all school-age children nationwide, reports the National Home Educators Research Institute. Brian Ray, its president, is expecting the number of homeschool students will increase by at least 10%. One day the school district says X, and 4 days later they say Y, Ray said. And then the governor says another thing, and then that changes what the school district can do. And parents? They are tired of it and saying, we are out of here, he said. Interest in homeschooling materials also has been rising. Even parents who plan to keep their children in schools are looking for ways to improve the distance learning they will receive. The National Homeschool Association reports that before COVID-19 appeared, it received between 5 and 20 requests for information on homeschooling each day. In comparison, it received 3,400 such inquiries on a single day last month. Clearly, the interest we have been getting has exploded, said J. Allen Weston, the executive director of the Colorado-based group. That is really the only way to describe it, he added. Some parents in rural Nebraska are turning to homeschooling because their school systems are unable to offer online learning, said Catherine Dillo. She leads Nebraska Homeschools, a support group. Homeschooling applications continue arriving in Nebraska, where the number of homeschoolers already had risen to 3,400 as of July 14th. That is up from 2,800 at the same time a year ago, said David Jesperson, a spokesman for the Nebraska Department of Education. Jesperson said there is a lot of confusion and that parents are delayed in making their decision because so much is changing. Most states do not have homeschooling numbers, either because they do not collect them or they have yet to get a final count. But all signs point to increases across the country. In Missouri, calls and emails to the homeschool group Families for Home Education increase every time a district releases its reopening plan, said Charity Jackson, the group's leader. She said families are in a panic about plans for the new school year. They are asking, what am I supposed to be doing with my children when I am working full-time, she said. Some families only plan to homeschool for a term or two, some in small groups. Jackson's advice to them centers on how to make sure students can transition back to public schooling easily when the pandemic ends. There are also some signs the move to homeschooling could continue well into fall. Christina Rothermill Branham is a psychology professor at Northeastern State University in Oklahoma. Her 6-year-old son is to start the new school term online through public school. But Rothermill Branham said the district's program in the spring was very monotonous. She will change to homeschooling, she said, if the first month of public school goes poorly. I'm Katie Weaver.
Now we bring you our American history program, The Making of a Nation. Today we look at the start of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The road to revolution in the late 1700s took several years. There were protests against the British policy of taxing the colonies without giving them representation in Parliament. To prevent trouble, the British sent thousands of soldiers to Boston, the largest city in Massachusetts. Jane Gordon, the Director of Education and Public Programs at the Massachusetts Historical Society, explains the mood at the time.
We're looking at a time of great tension. We're looking at a time when there's an expectation, I think, on both sides that something will happen, but nobody knows exactly what or when.
On March 5th, 1770, that tension led to violence. It was the end of winter, but the weather was still very cold. A small group of colonists began throwing rocks and pieces of ice at soldiers guarding a public building. They were joined by others, and the soldiers became frightened. They fired their guns. 5 colonists were killed. The shooting became known as the Boston Massacre. The people of Massachusetts were extremely angry. The soldiers were tried in court for murder. Most of them were found innocent. The others received minor punishments. Fearing more violence, the British Parliament removed most of the taxes on the colonists. Only the tax on tea remained. The tensions eased for a while. Imports of British goods increased. The colonists seemed satisfied with the situation until a few years later. Then the Massachusetts colony once again became involved in a dispute with Great Britain. The trouble started because the government wanted to help the British East India Company. That company organized all the trade between India and other countries in the British Empire. By 1773, the company had become weak. The British government decided to let the company sell tea directly to the American colonies. The colonies would still have to pay a tea tax. The Americans did not like this new plan. They felt they were being forced to buy their tea from only one company. Officials in the colonies of Pennsylvania and New York sent ships from the East India Company back to Britain. In Massachusetts, the British governor wanted to collect the tea tax and enforce the law. When the ships arrived in Boston, some colonists tried to block their way. The ships remained just outside the harbor without unloading their goods. On the night of December 16, 1773, a group of colonists went out in a small boat. They got on a British ship and threw all the tea into the water. Destroying the tea was a serious crime. The colonists were dressed as American Indians, so the British would not recognize them. But the people of Boston knew who they were. A crowd gathered to cheer them. That incident, the night when British tea was thrown into Boston Harbor, became known as the Boston Tea Party.
And all of a sudden, with the Tea Party, they say, enough is enough.
Gordon Wood, a history professor at Brown University in Rhode Island, says the Tea Party made Britain furious with the colonies. Parliament reacted by passing a series of laws that punished the whole Massachusetts colony for the actions of a few men. One of these laws closed the port of Boston until the tea was paid for. Other laws strengthened the power of the British governor and weakened the power of local officials throughout the colonies. The laws were called the Coercive Acts. Historian Gordon Wood says they helped unite all the colonies against Britain, even though not everybody approved of the Boston Tea Party.
The Virginians are appalled at the Tea Party. They just think that's just terrible, destruction of all that property. But when they see what the British do, the Coercive Acts, they say to themselves, if they can do that to Massachusetts, the British can do that to us. And they're on board. And that really is the turning point.
In June of 1774, Massachusetts called for a meeting of delegates from all the other colonies to consider joint action against Britain. This meeting was called the First Continental Congress. It was held in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in September of 1774. All the colonies except one were represented. The southern colony of Georgia did not send a delegate. The delegates agreed that the British Parliament had no right to control trade with the American colonies or to make any laws that affected them. They said the people of the colonies must have the right to take part in any legislative group that made laws for them. The First Continental Congress approved a series of documents that condemned all British actions in the colonies after 1763. The delegates approved a proposal by Massachusetts saying that the people could use weapons to defend their rights. They also organized a Continental Association to boycott British goods and to stop all exports to any British colony or to Britain itself. Local committees were created to enforce the boycott. One of the delegates to the First Continental Congress was John Adams of Massachusetts. Years later, he would say that by the time the meeting took place, the American Revolution had already begun. King George II announced that the New England colonies were in rebellion. Parliament made the decision to use troops against the colonists in Massachusetts in January of 1775. The people of Massachusetts formed a provincial assembly and began training men to fight. Soon, armed groups were doing military exercises in towns all around Massachusetts and in other colonies. British officers received their orders in April 1775. By that time, the colonists had been gathering weapons in the town of Concord, about 30 kilometers west of Boston.
It's a gentle landscape. There are no great mountains. There are no great valleys or waterfalls. It's a gently rolling hillside farm landscape. There are two rivers that come together to form another river.
Jane Gordon from the Massachusetts Historical Society lives in the area. She describes what the scene must have been like.
The houses are mostly made of wood. Many of them are not painted. In April, the leaves would just be budding out. Things would be greening up. And actually, the first day of the Revolution was a very warm spring day.
The British forces were ordered to seize the colonists' weapons. But the colonists were prepared. They knew that the British were coming. Years later, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem about what happened. The poem is about Paul Revere, one of three men who helped warn the colonial troops that the British were coming.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One, if by land, and two, if by sea. And I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm."
When the British reached the town of Lexington, they found it protected by about 70 colonial troops. These citizen soldiers were called Minutemen. They had been trained to fight with only a minute's warning. Eight colonists were killed. Each side accused the other of firing the first shot in that first battle of the American Revolution. It became known as the shot heard round the world. From Lexington, the British marched to Concord, where they destroyed whatever supplies the colonists had not been able to save. Other colonial troops rushed to the area. A battle at Concord's North Bridge forced the British to march back to Boston. It was the first day of America's War for Independence. When it was over, almost 300 British troops had been killed. Fewer than 100 Americans had died. The British troops had marched in time with their drummers and pipers playing Yankee Doodle. A Yankee Doodle was a man who did not know how to fight. The song was meant to insult the Americans, but in the end, they were very proud of it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.